Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. You're going to love him. His name is Johan Ilgenfritz. Johan is a father of two boys, a husband for 32 years, a former fashion photographer, and lately he's the founder and CEO of UK Health Radio Network. And he's going to tell us all about that. He's definitely got an amazing story. And welcome to the studio, Johan.
Hello, dear Hillary. Lovely to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Yes, thank you. So I had originally contacted Johan about see if he had spots on his network, but he did not at the time. We're still waiting for that. But in the meantime, he told me his story. And we were like, oh my God, you got to be on my show to tell this story. So, wow. So, all right. Where would you like to begin your story? How you got into fashion photography? Or where'd you grow up? Let's start there. Where did you grow up?
I'm a German national. I grew up in South Africa, though. Went to school there, went to university there, studied art, studied photography. At a university very close to Johannesburg. And also worked in publishing for a publishing company. They we had five magazines as they were started out as the in-house photographer. And then later on, I started my own studio, but still did a lot of work for them in between, photographing really interesting people like the Oppenheimers, Nelson Mandela. I had the privilege of photographing twice. Once in a very, it was at one of the ANC's get-togethers. They used to have these weekly get-togethers, so it was a very almost informal discussion. And once for the cover of one of the magazines that I did work for. So yeah, very interesting. Time in South Africa at that stage. It was just before during the transition from apartheid to what it is now.
Wow.
What
kind of publication was it that you were doing this for?
The publishing company, as I mentioned, had five magazines. Right. So they had and one of them that I did photograph Nelson Mandela for was called Tribute. It was basically the first really high-gloss black magazine. A magazine whose main clientele were for the black people in South Africa. But it was quite something. It was high-gloss. It was really a super magazine, yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. Okay. So from there, was your main thing was photography, right?
Yeah. Yes. I studied photography for 5 years at uni. And then leapt at the chance. The magazine South Africa, the world, the photography world, it or wasn't, perhaps it's changed now. I haven't lived there for 30 odd years, so 32 years as well. So, but the it wasn't that big. The industry wasn't that big. So most of the photographers had to do more than one thing. You know, here in Europe, you're either a fashion photographer or a food photographer or a wedding photographer or what, whichever the case, there you had to do a variety of areas to basically, you know, stay alive, to make ends meet, etc. So, and it was actually a very good thing because later on, after I moved to Europe, it actually came, really helped me going forward. So I had the opportunity to do a lot of people work, like photography, Mr. Mandela, etc. I also did a lot of fashion work, etc. So it all helped me later on.
Okay. All right. So you did that for how many years there?
It was about four or five years, yes.
Okay. And then where did you go? Is that when you went to Europe? Or?
And then I had an opportunity to go and work in Milan for 3 months. It was I knew from the word go, it would only be for 3 months. But my wife and I, Raphael and myself, took that as an opportunity to make the transition. We sold everything we had. We put it in storage. We came to Italy for 3 months. And during those 3 months, we had all our stuff shipped over to Germany at that point. And so when that job finished, we went to Germany and, we settled. First spent a bit of time with her family. They were gracious enough to put us up for a month or two for us to find our feet. And then we sort of settled in and started the life in Europe.
Wow. So where in Germany did you go?
We went to, it's a small town. It's very close to Düsseldorf, which is sort of in the middle of Germany. That's where Raphael's family are from. And then we had to decide we looked at Germany. We looked at where the main hubs were for photography. And the one was in Hamburg in the north, and the one was in Munich in the south. And my German was a little rusty at the point. So, and the South Germans have quite an accent. It's really quite difficult. Even today, when my German isn't rusty anymore, I still sometimes find it quite hard to understand. So we picked Hamburg.
Wow.
It's a very scientific.
Well, how did you, if you were a German national, how did you end up growing up in South Africa? Were you born in Germany or no?
No, I was born in South Africa.
Okay. But your family's
from, correct, yes.
Where were they from? What part of Germany were they from?
My father is from Rothenburg ob der Tauber. If you've ever seen any tourist photographs of Germany, that's where they come. That's where they photographed. It's the
capital,
most.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's with the. It's a little medieval town. It's still got the moat around it.
Mm.
It's absolutely idyllic. It really is. It's, as I said, I try and go and visit my family there once a year, and it's incredible. It's beautiful.
How did your father get to South Africa, or who went there first?
His grandparents went.
His grandparents.
Oh, my grandparents. Sorry, his parents, my grandparents.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And why did they leave Germany?
Very good question. They left Germany 18, my grandfather 18, I think it was 98, and my grandmother. Separately, they weren't married. They met in South Africa. My grandmother, as a single woman, left Germany in 1904 and immigrated to South Africa, which at that point, especially South Africa was importing people to come and help them build the country, importing engineers, importing people from Holland, a lot of people from the Netherlands, from Germany, from Belgium, all over the place, from France even, many went to South Africa to help build.
I wonder how they traveled back then, right?
Ship.
Yep.
Yeah, apparently. So, yeah. Very.
Where would you get on? Because Germany's not near the water, right? Where would They would have to go
from Hamburg. Hamburg has a, well, Hamburg isn't near the water, but it has this huge access to the ocean. So it's a huge harbor city, Hamburg. That's where I lived later on as well. I lived there for 24 years.
Wow, that's so interesting. So did you still have family back in Hamburg?
I don't have family in Hamburg.
Oh, at Rotenburg.
Right. In Rotenburg, yes. I still have a cousin, which is very dear to me. He's in a guard. He's an incredible man. He's the brewmaster in Germany. In Rotenburg. And it's fantastic to hear his stories of his life and his occupation. And everybody in Rotenburg knows him, of course, as well.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking of the early 1900s, there was no wars, but so your cousin his family lasted through the wars, right?
They did, yes.
World War I and II. Wow.
Yeah. Those that, other than my grandparents, basically, they went through both wars, yes.
Wow. Amazing, right?
Yeah.
Whew. Okay. So I only know from books. So, all right. But we had family there, but not on the German side, on the other side, that some didn't make it in the concentration camps. But we won't go there. So anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. So next. So, all right. So you move back. You move with your wife. You didn't have your kids yet, right? Tockenburg. Okay. And was your wife a photographer too?
No, she's a designer, a graphic designer. Very, very talented. She worked for the biggest Sunday newspaper in South Africa at that time. As I said, now she is the head designer for UK Health Radio. She designs magazines. She does so much incredible work as well. Yeah.
Wow. So you guys left. You had a 3-month thing. You left South Africa to go to Milan. And then you said Hamburg, Munich. You chose Hamburg. How old were you then when you made this big switch?
I was 28 when we left Johannesburg, yes.
Were you nervous or excited? Like, did you ever think, what the hell are we doing? Or you just did it?
A few times after we were there, I thought, what the hell are you doing? But before that, it was so exciting. I had this major opportunity in Milan. It was exciting. It was, we were young. We, as you mentioned, we didn't have children yet or anything. And we just tackled it. We just grabbed it by the scruff of the neck and off.
Wow, that's so great. Good for you, you know? I think when we get older, we get a little careful. But when we're younger, it's like, yeah, let's go. So, okay. All right. So when you got there, what happened? Then what happened?
It wasn't very easy either, coming from Africa. Being one of the best in Africa doesn't mean you're one of the best in Europe. To be honest, you are, you are absolutely unknown and nobody cares or anything else. But yeah, there was, we knew that. If you thought about it for longer than 30 seconds, you would know that. And we did. We knew that it was going to be a long, hard journey. And we just tackled it. I mentioned before, we had two in South Africa. I did many aspects of photography. And that actually really worked in my favor once I got to Germany, because I could do work in 3 or 4 areas where other people were only sort of trained and channeled in one area. I had everything to my ability, and it actually worked out. The Germans didn't like my fashion work. They didn't like my style. I think it was just too much, too edgy, too everything for them. But they loved my product work. So I ended up, it sounds very quickly, it wasn't. It took about 5 years of hard slog. But I actually ended up having the Nivea contract for 5 years in Hamburg, where everything the world saw of Nivea products, I photographed.
Is that a German product?
Nivea is a German product.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So after 5 years, that's when you started getting...
Well, that's when the big, that was a big break. That was really a wide break for me, you know. So, I mean, I'd been working and doing that. I also, within the 5 years, I also had the opportunity. I was invited to do a master's degree in Hamburg, which I grabbed, as again, with both hands. Yeah. So I have a master's degree in photography. And that just opened many, many, many doors for me as well. Many, got to know a lot of people. Saw the most incredible exhibitions, you know, that were involved with that whole setup, the master, the university, etc. So that was very, a very wonderful thing, actually.
Okay, so by now, you took 5 years and then 5 years with Nivea, so now you're 38, right, around at this point?
Yeah, plus minus, yes.
So you have your kids yet? Were your kids born yet?
Yes, my eldest son was born when I was 36.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So then keep going. So you have
So during these 5 years as well while working in Hamburg, I came to London and I showed my portfolio around, and the work that I was doing wasn't too edgy for the British public or for the British magazines. They actually liked it. So I was working in London under the name Gecko. That was my artist's name, because I have this affinity with geckos from Africa already. I loved them. I used to have geckos as toys and as pets and all kinds of things, you know. So I always had geckos around me. So in London, I worked under the name Gecko. In the fashion, and in Hamburg, I worked under Johann Ilgenfritz, and the two worlds knew nothing of each other. So, yeah, it was actually frowned upon if you did both. But then,
really?
No, because as I said, I did it under two names in two different countries. So,
did you move there to London, or you just traveled?
We moved to London, and not then. We only moved to London 8 years ago.
Oh.
So after UK Health Radio Network was started, we lived in Hamburg until it got just too much traveling. I wasn't seeing my family anymore. They weren't, you know, they didn't see me. So we decided to move over here.
Wow. So how many years was that?
Well, that all happened almost at the same time with Nivea and...
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right. So then you moved 8 years ago. When did the, you know, diagnosis come?
That was all 13 years ago. I was diagnosed. So we were still living in Hamburg. It was 2011.
Okay.
Not many people know that, but first I had a light heart attack on the tennis court. And then 3 months later, after neither me or the doctors could work out why I wasn't feeling better and getting well and getting more energetic, I was diagnosed with cancer for the first time.
And what kind was it?
It actually started out, I had two kinds of cancer. Nodular melanoma is the one, the most aggressive skin cancer you can get. And the other one, was a melanotic melanoma, which is, it's not quite as aggressive, but it's actually more dangerous because it can grow under the skin. You can't see it. And even if it's on top of the skin, it doesn't have the pigmentation. So it's skin tone. It's not, doesn't go like normal dark, you know? So it's got no melanin in it. So, and of course, they spread, it metastasized, it spread to my lungs. All in all, I had 7 tumors. Even had one in my left eye.
Oof.
But that was Yeah, as I said, that was the first first diagnosis. I did radiotherapy, two sets in the end of radiotherapy. But this was a very, not because literally of the diagnosis, but because of me, of my action, my reaction to this diagnosis was terrible. I was absolutely useless. You know, I stumbled into radiotherapy. I ended up doing two sets of radiotherapy. Came out of it the other side cancer clear for a short while. But the whole time during this first diagnosis, I had this feeling that there was something missing. You know, nobody told me what to do. They didn't tell me what to eat. They didn't tell me if I could exercise or not. My only duty really was to be at the actual, you know, be there for the therapy. That was my only duty. But you know what the worst thing was, Hillary? I didn't ask you. And I think that was the thing that in the back of my mind, that was, I was just stumbling around in this haze, if I could call it, lack of any other word, you know? So it was, as I said, I did get the cancer free.
So was that up until the diagnosis, and then obviously you had the light heart attack. And then you got the diagnosis. Is that when you got into the haze, like something?
Yes, the diagnosis really threw me. I was with the first diagnosis, I was 46. I had a 11 and a 2-year-old boy. Boys, you know, it's like I was just, as I said, I was useless. I was absolutely in a haze.
If you don't want to talk about it, it's fine. But like, was it because you thought you were going to die? Was it because you were powerless? Like what do you think? Cause I can feel it as you're saying it, but what do you think that was almost like paralyzed you? The fear or the death or the, what do you think it was?
Definitely everything you mentioned as well. The of course, there's fear involved. Naturally, there's fear involved, especially with a young family, etc. But I think the main thing that worried me was I wasn't part of this process. I was being told, I was being done to, and I wasn't doing anything myself. I wasn't constructively or actively doing anything. I had no, as I said, I had no duties. I only had to be there for the treatment. That was, from my perspective of what was happening, the only duty I had. And it is quite a diagnosis to get at 46.
Especially when you said it was the most aggressive, but they stopped it. How did they do that? That's amazing, right?
Yeah, the radiotherapy. That's why I'm all about integrative medicine, because I think it's so important to use everything to our availability. Everything there is to our availability, we should use. I always say to people, if you want to build a house, you can't build a house only with screwdrivers. You need hammers, you need saws, you need nails, you know, the whole thing. So why do we do that when it comes to our health? We saw it limited only to one thing, only holistic or only allopathic. Why? It's ridiculous, actually.
So after you did the two sets, you were cancer clear. Then what happened?
Life went on as usual, unfortunately.
And so you went back to regular life. You were still at the temple.
Yeah. I hadn't learned anything from it. I hadn't changed anything through it. I just stumbled along as before.
Okay.
So the second diagnosis. But somehow, the second diagnosis I had during my first post-cancer screening. I was like, I'll never forget the day. I was sitting in my oncologist's office, and she said to me, "Johan, I'm really sorry to tell you this. We don't know what's happened, but it's just spread everywhere." And she said to me, "The way it is now, we can't do anything for you. You've got about 12 months to live. That's it."
So this was the second kind of the melanoma.
Well, it had metastasized, as I said, and spread. And but the good part of this was my.
How did they find it the first time? Just so people will know, like, I know you had the heart attack and you didn't feel well. What had them figure it out the first time?
I took my son to the skin specialist and she picked it up. So I wasn't there for the consultation. My son was there. My son was had a skin irritation that she was looking at. And she said to me, "What is that in your face? Have you had it looked at?" And I went, "What?"
Oh, so she said, so it was on your face.
It was on my face in the beginning. It was here. And she saw it. And they actually removed the skin to expose to see how big it was.
Yeah.
They remove it with acid. They put the acid
on. That day? Wow.
And no. This was, but I think it was 2 or 3 days later. It was quite quick. It all happened very quickly. They removed the skin and they exposed it. And in the end, my whole, everything there like that was which you couldn't see, was under the skin. It had grown in under the skin. So that's how it started. That's how it was discovered purely the first time.
Wow.
Yeah, purely by accident.
Wow. Lucky, right? Yeah. Thank God for your son. Okay. So then when they told, how did they know it had metastasized when you went back?
Well, we went through all the scans and the screenings and everything, the blood tests and all that. And then when I got all the results back, that was what I mentioned just a bit earlier when she said to me it had spread. So, yeah.
Okay. So 12 months. So this time, what did you do different this time?
It was my reaction. I'll never forget that. I'm sitting in her office and she's telling me all this. And something must have, in the back of my mind, must have happened between me becoming cancer-free and the second diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Because when she told me, I actually heard my own voice in the back of my head screaming at me, "You're not going to die.
Wow.
We'll sort this." And you know what that voice also said to me? And I've stuck, and it has clung to me all the time. And I tell people this all the time. A diagnosis is only somebody's professional opinion. It's not chiseled into stone. It's
right.
Purely an opinion,
right,
of somebody. And for the, and that is really important. That point is really important for me to get across, because it's so many people give up because of a diagnosis. In my case, it was like a bit of a kick in the bum. It really got me going.
Wow.
But in many cases, people sort of resignate. They go, "Okay, well, terminal, what must I do?" You know? And that is wrong. As I say, it's only somebody's opinion.
All right.
Else.
Wow.
So I got up. I left her office. I went home. I told my wife that the cancer had returned. I didn't tell her about the terminal 12 months thing.
Ooh.
But I knew that I would find another way of doing this. So the first option hadn't worked. So I thought to myself, go and find another option or options. It doesn't matter where, how, whatever. You know, it's like, and a lot of people have said to me, "Why didn't you tell your wife?" I was afraid that if I would voice it, I would make it real. It would become real. It would become actual. So, later on she realized it because my health deteriorated really quite rapidly in that towards the end of those 12 months, you know?
Oh.
So she did, she could see it and she asked me, and it did come out and all that. But in the beginning, I went home. I told her about the diagnosis, you know, about the cancer returning, and I started looking for options. Literally, the same day.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. On that note, we want to hear about what you did. We're going to go a quick break to our sponsor, and then we'll be right back to hear the rest of the story. Wow, I can't wait to hear. Okay. All right. We'll be right back, everyone.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to RealTalkWithHillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Welcome back to the Getting Real with Hillary Show. And as always, thanks to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. Kikori is a experiential social-emotional learning platform. And you can bring it to your schools, you can bring it to your businesses, to your teams. If you want to get more connected socially or have your kids get off maybe their phones, their devices, and get more with people, check out KikoriApp.com. You will be so happy that you did. My daughter works for the company. It's a startup, and it's just really, it just makes a huge difference for anyone. I've done the activities. You feel so loving and so connected. It's like magical. So that's that. And then my books, let's see. I'm going to show you my first book. This is my memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast. If you ever feel stuck, the subtitle, If Marriage Was My Dream, Why Was I Numbing Myself? If you find yourself numbing yourself, you might want to check this out, because I got out of that rut and kind of rebuilt my life to a life I love. And if you want to do that, you can get it on Amazon, The Second Piece of French Toast. It really might inspire you or someone you know. This is my third book. This one is called Your Bullshit is Your Blessing, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun. I used to think there was something wrong with me because I wasn't like my mother. She's always perky and peppy, and I had moments when I was upset. And I didn't think I should. So this was about accepting how I was, stop trying to fix myself, and start having more fun. And I even could play with complaints and being upset and negativity. So if that is you or someone you know, you can find that one, all of them on Amazon. Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. And this one is the one that the commercial was about. This is also something I learned all of this from my first book. This one is called Real Talk. Someone had asked me why I didn't speak up when I was married. And I was like, didn't know I didn't. So anyway, this is all about that. And if you're someone who doesn't speak up, you can go to realtalkwithhillary.com and check it out. There's a quiz to see do you speak up? And anyway, you can do that. You can get in touch with me and we can get you speaking and way more powerful and having a life you love. And now we're going to bring back Johan Ilgenfriz, also known as Gecko, right?
Not anymore.
Yeah, not anymore. But I thought you were going to talk about Geico when you said Gecko. Yeah. I thought that was you. So anyway, okay. So you've just, let's go back. You were just given the diagnosis. You went home. You started looking for options that day. What did you do?
Yeah. What followed were 7 months, seven really dark months, I have to admit, of hundreds of pieces of paper printed out, information flying all over the show at home. Until one night, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, I read a very short little sentence. It says, cancer cannot survive in an oxygenated alkaline cellular environment. And for me, at that point, it felt like I was standing in a dark stadium and somebody switched on all the floodlights. It just clicked. I realized that I actually woke Rafaela at 2 o'clock in the morning and I actually physically said to her, I have found a way not to die. Because at this point, 7 months into my allotted 12,
yeah,
as I now jokingly say, I was really ill. Just to give you an example, it took me 20 minutes to walk up 2 flights of stairs that day when I read that. So not well at all anymore. And what that means basically is it was written by a German biochemist, Dr. Otto Warburg. And he actually won a Nobel Prize for it in 1931.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but for me, it just resonated. I can only but agree with your reaction.
How did you find it? Was just random?
It was purely random. It was purely an internet search that I was on. And mustn't forget, I'd accumulated a lot of information during those 7 months. And it was just a progression of what I was plodding along, basically, and read that. But the millisecond I read it, I knew that was it. That was what was going to save my life, as I said to my wife. So what that means is that basically it's all about our internal pH.
Yeah.
And what that means is that cancer cells, this we know, this is scientifically proven, they feed on glucose, on sugar. That is their main source of nutrition. So if you can alkalize your body, you basically starve them to death. In theory, that's the theory part of it.
It's nothing plain.
The sugar. You need to do something. No, the sugar comes from all food or certain food.
All food. Yeah, that is the tricky bit. So, what that means is, I basically became a vegetarian overnight, literally overnight.
Wow.
And 2 or 3 weeks later, I became a vegan. Today, I'm an alkaline vegan. I only eat alkaline food, which is naturally a vegan diet.
It is or it isn't?
It is.
It is.
It's a pure vegan diet. So no meats, no poultry, no fish, no anything like that. So it's all about your blood pH. You don't have that much control over. But your pH on your cellular level, there where the cancer is, that you can control through diet. It's not only diet. At that stage, that's all I knew. Now I know that stress and there's a lot of other factors that can also acidify us on a cellular level. And my journey's gone through all of them. But that was the start. That was my anchor. And I still today think it is 70% of everything is your diet.
So what? Tell me what you do eat.
Well, most green leaves, that you know, like the spinaches, the broccolis, the peas, beans, you know, that kind of cabbage, cauliflower, that is basically what I eat. I know it sounds terribly boring, but it's not. It's actually, once you get into it, it's actually a culinary excursion. It's quite a journey that we've been on. You know? So, but you've just got to be like meats, all that is all acidic. Like, so we all have a pH in us. 7.2 is neutral. Anything below 7.2 goes into the acidic side of things, which causes glucose, which causes sugar, which is what cancer cells nourish themselves from. And everything above that is alkaline. So you're taking away all the nutrients from the cancers.
And what about protein?
Protein, yeah, that's basically the first question I always get asked. Protein, I get all my protein from vegetables.
Well,
an avocado, an average sized avocado has more protein in it than a porter steak. Yeah, and I'm a marathon runner. I don't run full marathons. I run half marathons. I'm 61 years old now. Not quite. In 5 days, I'm 62. And I run 4 or 5 half marathons a year. So yes, very, very important.
Do you eat beans or anything like that, or nuts, or just vegetables?
Nuts, definitely. But I only eat almonds. Almond is actually the only alkaline nut. All the others are quite acidic sometimes, especially peanuts and stuff like that. Really acidic. Got to be really careful with them. Yeah.
And beans? Are beans okay?
Beans, some beans are okay, some aren't. It's actually quite straightforward. If anybody's listening, all they need to do is to go onto the internet and download what they call an alkaline food chart. There are thousands of them, literally. Wow. And you can, and they just list, you know, everything from pH 3, which is like black tea, soya, like pork, veal, beef, lamb, all that is pH 3. It was like absolutely the worst. And then all the way up to high alkaline, which is pH 10, which is like, what I just mentioned, like kale, you know, everything from pH 3, which is like black tea, soya, like pork, veal, beef, lamb, all that is pH 3. It was like absolutely the worst. And then all the way up to high alkaline, which is pH 10. Which is like, what I just mentioned, like kale, you know, everything from pH 3, which is like black tea, soya, like pork. But this is how I felt. I explain it. I always say it probably wasn't much more than a 2-foot wave for anybody else. But for me, it felt that I was surfing a tsunami. I had energy for the first time, and that just helped me know that I was doing the right thing. I was on the right path. Now, I have to mention this isn't a quick fix. It took me 2.5 years to get rid of all the tumors. As I mentioned before, I had 7. 2 were operable. They were removed. But the other 5, including the one in my lungs and my eye, they weren't operable. So, as I said, this is not a quick fix. It took 2.5 years for everything to happen. But the turnaround was really incredible, because I could feel myself getting stronger. I could feel myself getting better.
Wow.
as the years went past. And this was also the type of an idea where UK Health Radio actually originated from. Mm-hmm. I wanted to, and today even more than then, I want to prevent people from having to go through that dark time I went through. Now, I once said to my wife, and I mean, you've heard my story. I'm not a person that gives up. But I said to her one day, just to explain how I was feeling, I said to her, "No, why am I waiting around for this? Why don't I just jump out the window, get it over and done with?" Because everything I was researching and everything I was reading was all dark and dingy, and you are going to die and it is going to be painful. You know what I mean? And that is what I wanted, and still today, with every fiber of my being, want to prevent from happening to other people. I wanted to create a platform where people can go to and get the best quality information done in a positive manner. You can talk about really serious things and you know, but you can do it in a positive manner. It can have a positive twinge to it. And that, I only ask two things of our presenters, and that is that they do it with integrity and in a positive manner. So what, I still had cancer when I started this, and I actually used the radio as well to gather information for myself, because now I started realizing that stress was a huge part of acidifying your body. That's now, of course, many years later, been scientifically proven as well. As a photographer, I was always under the gun, always under time pressure. So we don't get away from time. We don't get away from stress anymore. But we can identify which area is causing us getting ill. And you can handle it. You can manage it. What I did was I lengthened my day so that I could do things at a normal pace and not speeding through everything. I mean, now, of course, it's increased it as UK Health Radio has grown. It's increased tremendously. So I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I start work. I use that time as well for my meditation. I started meditating. Things I used to laugh at, I now do myself. I tried yoga. It doesn't work for me. I run. My wife says I look like a fallen over dead tree when I'm doing yoga. I call it all four Qs. IQ, PQ, physical intelligence, spiritual intelligence, and emotional intelligence. I learned to look at myself through the lenses of all four of the cues. And I now know that you can't do one of the cues without doing any of the rest and expecting it to be a great result. You've got to do all four. Not necessarily at the same time, but you've got to build them up together, very importantly. So, as I said, the meditation, the physical part of it. As I said, that little sentence, cancer cannot survive in an oxygenated, alkaline cellular environment. So sport, oxygen in there is vitally important. As I mentioned, I run. I've always done sport. I've always played tennis. I did martial arts when I was a young man, etc. During lockdown, when everything closed down, I couldn't play tennis. I couldn't do anything. So I started running, and it's been life-saving for me. It's been incredible. I can even meditate while I'm running. I do quantum meditations while I'm running.
Wow. I
trained myself to do this over the years. Over the months and years of running. So it's, I don't run with headphones. I don't run with music. I run only with myself. It's incredible. It's become such a huge part of my life, actually.
So, okay. Yeah. So we have 6 minutes left. Okay. I just want to know real quick, how did you actually start the radio station? Like, how do you just start? Part one.
That was another middle of the night action. I woke my wife. I've always thought radio was a very personal medium. If you do it correctly, and we do at UK Health Radio, the person listening, no matter where they are in the world and no matter how many people they are, each and every person can feel as if the moderator or the guest is speaking to them personally. Okay. I always thought that of radio. So that was the reason for radio. And I wanted it internet because I didn't want it local. I wanted it worldwide. Mm-hmm. And we started with one presenter, Robert Scott Bell. He was actually an American homeopath who is massive. He's been doing this for 30 years. He's got a show on many local radio stations in the U.S. And he gave me his show. And for the first 3 months, we had two listeners. One was me, myself, and I. I think the other one was Rafaela. She's never admitted it, but I'm sure it was her. Today, we have 1.5 million listeners worldwide. We have 46 presenters doing 42 shows. So it's been quite an expansion. We have Health Triangle Magazine, which is a UK health radio network magazine. And there's something I did want to mention today as well. I have personally, over and above the radio and the magazine, personally, I have started, it's called the Alkaline Collective. It's a mastermind that I've created for people that have cancer, that have beaten cancer and want to stay cancer-free, or that just want to prevent it from happening. Middle of November, I'll be publishing my first book, which I'm really excited about. It's called Cancer Cell Suicide.
Ooh.
The philosophy of Resnack. You caused it, you can reverse it. Now, Resnack is just cancer written the other way around. That's how it is. And that's what it means. I know this is a very tricky thing to say, but I just want to mention this very quickly. Only 5 to 10% of all cancer-related illnesses on the planet today is genetically inherited. The other 90 to 95% is contributed to our lifestyles, with nutrition and toxic overload being the top two culprits. So we are basically doing it to ourselves, this, in most cases, as I said. Not in all, 5 to 10% not, but in most cases. That's also why I said, you caused it, you can reverse it. Because that's what I did.
Yeah.
I caused it and I reversed it. So, yeah. That is the position at the moment. I'm still... I'm in this for the long run. I want, people say to me quite often, how many listeners do I don't have? Do you want 3 or 5 million? I go, why? We 8 billion people on the planet. Why would I be happy with 5 million? I want every single person. That is my purpose. My purpose is to put UK Health Radio into every single dwelling on the planet and then get every person in every dwelling to listen to us, to interact with us, to subscribe to the magazine. The radio and the listen on demand and the podcast, that's all for nothing. That's all free, free of charge. You can just listen. And that is my purpose. No, Mark Twain once said, there are two important days in every person's life, the day you're born and the day you find out why. And that is the reason I've been on this journey, is I found out why. Why I'm here, what I'm here to do, and why I'm helping and going to help many people, and I've helped many people in many different ways. Some like to listen, some like to read, some like that personal thing with the Alkaline Collective Mastermind. Some like that interaction, that personal affection, that personal energy, if I could put it that way. So I will continue to build as many pillars as I can to inform people, to educate people, to help people.
Wow. Wow, amazing. All right. So in the last 45 seconds, what would you like to leave people with? If this took off, what would the world look like in your vision?
I just want everybody to become part of their health process. Don't leave it to individuals other than yourselves. Don't ostracize them either. Don't cut them out, but work with them. Inform them. Ask the questions that maybe you don't want to ask or they don't want to be asked. Sometimes even better. Be part of the process. Nobody's going to fight for your life the way you are. That doctor, that surgeon, they've got 30, 40 patients. They cannot be as passionate about it as what you can be. And as I said, never, ever give up. That diagnosis is only somebody's opinion.
Wow. Whew, well, thank you. Just really thank you. Thank you for doing what you're doing and the difference you're making. It's really powerful, courageous, and inspiring. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Hillary, for doing what you do, you know, for helping me spread the word, for helping me get this information out. It's so important. I mean, if nobody knew about it, my work would be null and void. But through yourself and through people like yourself, we're getting this word out. And thank you for that. Thank you for who you are and for everything you do.
You're welcome. Thank you. All right. Bye, everyone.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.